This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Shelley. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the episode.
There is this notion that people in a newsroom are smart enough to weigh the pressures of competition against ethical considerations, but the pressures of competition will always win.
Woman driven to the brink by abuse, cut off her husband's penis, and we all focused on the penis. A man tricked into taking a male crush's confession on a national talk show, shot the man with the crush on him, and we all focused on the talk show. Was the 90s the golden age of tabloid true crime stories or the nadir of compassion? After a fortnight of true crime fan and podcaster self-examination about the genre, exploitation, and who crime stories belong to, Piper Weiss has returned to discuss Lorena and Talked to Death is perfectly timed, so don't touch that dial. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 85. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. More than pretty good is my guest, Piper Weiss, who is back to discuss the new Amazon Prime series, Lorena, and the fairly old documentary, Talk to Death. Hello, Piper. Thanks for coming back so soon.
Oh, my God, Sarah. I'm so happy to be here on the 85th episode. Very impressive.
How did I do that?
I'm really impressed.
Where does the time go? speaking of that... where did the Lorena and John Wayne Bobbitt cases feel like they were much more recent than more than 25 years ago, honestly. In our Most Wanted section, we are talking about the new docuseries Lorena, which concerns the case and the principals and various other issues surrounding it. In case anyone did not watch any late night television ever or is unfamiliar with the case, here's the case file. On June 23rd, 1993, Lorena Bobbitt made tabloid history and became a verb in her own right. When she cut off her husband John Wayne Bobbitt's penis as he slept, then hurled it out the window of her car before calling 911. That she alleged he had raped her, that she said it wasn't the first time or the only kind of abuse she'd endured in the marriage, all of that was obscured by the titillation of the case and the severed member at its center. Despite taking its place in a grim line of stories that should have drawn attention to domestic violence, sexual harassment, and sexual assault, but focused instead on bagatelles like hot dog boxes, coke pubes, and stained dresses from the Gap. Amazon Prime's docuseries Lorena, produced by Jordan Peele and directed by Joshua Roffé, drops this coming Friday, February 15th, and tries to get us to pay attention right this time, in a four-part look back at the case, one that, much like the Slow Burn podcast did for Monica Lewinsky and others victimized by Bill Clinton, offers the viewer a second chance at compassion, empathy, and recognition. So, obviously, this series is not out yet, and spoiler warnings apply, although, again, I think even Mennonites are familiar with these names and what happened, but... it did all go down long enough ago that I, for one, was glad to get a second look at it that was a little more considered and less jokey. So, Piper, what did you think of... you've watched the entire series, yes?
Yes, indeed. I was glued to it.
Yes, same. It is not perfect, in my opinion. That I think it could have been a little... shorter. I'm not sure every episode needed to be over an hour. There were a lot of moody shots of Lorena going under underpasses and sort of going through light and shadow that I thought were, you know, we got it. But I also liked that in certain places they let her testimony at the time play out, even though it was very difficult to watch. I could have done with maybe a little warning about certain crime scene photos, if you know what I mean. They really don't spare you the details of the severance. But overall, I thought it was great, and I was almost grateful to have the chance to kind of respond to this case and these people better the second time around. What did you think of it overall?
Overall, I actually, I kind of wished it was a little longer. I wanted to see more of both Lorena and John Wayne's life now. I think you get a little glimpse just by, you know, the interview of John Wayne Bobbitt in his Lazy Boy white cushioned chair and his Big Gulp, and, you know, and Lorena speaking really eloquently about, you know, how she's kind of taken this in stride years later. But, you know, I kind of wanted to meet the other people in their lives, kind of follow a day in their life now, and how their lives looked now that it's calmed down, if they're still recognized. But other than that, yeah, I thought it was incredibly thorough, and it also took me back to a time when, you know, Howard Stern kind of like ruled the world. And reminded me that we are living still, you know, in the Donald Trump era, which is like, you know, if Howard Stern were president, you know, and it was chilling to see that kind of humor is now just, you know, in our White House.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up wanting to see more of Lorena and John's lives now, because I found some of the comments about John Wayne Bobbitt's mental acuity interesting. There was also like, he sort of had this moment at the end where he was talking about his childhood and being abused himself, and right, where his mom was. And it was like that now this comes up. It was like right, the end of episode four.
Yeah.
And it was kind of this, like, almost throwaway moment. But then there are a number of other points at which they're talking about the way he sees the world and his inability to lie. And the phrasing is very careful. But here's his defense attorney, who is sort of in the middle of talking about how initially he wanted no part of this case. And then he's talking about the case against John, and I'll play the clip and then we can discuss.
When I met him, John had scrape marks of nail marks straight down his face that had occurred 2 weeks before that. And John not earning much of a living. He's the dependent one in this relationship. We had a psychological test done on John. And John is not capable of really telling a lie, because he doesn't handle, he can't do the complexity that's required to make to sell a lie, if you will. One of the facts that impressed me the most was that the police had been called three or four times in their relationship. Three of those times, John had called them.
I mean, like the whole, I was trying to restrain her because she attacked me defense is enraging. And the number of times that I feel like we had to hear that in the context of OJ murdering Nicole Brown. Ugh. But I want to go back to the comment before that, which we get the same very careful phrasing about that a few times, which is that he's not like smart enough to lie. And he's not smart enough to, like, when they're when the people at the Bunny Ranch in Nevada are talking about his working there and how he was, like, incapable of learning to drive a limo, incapable of learning to serve drinks, that it's like, was his participation predicated on absolutely nobody calling him intellectually delayed? Is that what's happening here? Like, I don't...
Yeah. Yeah, there.
There was just this like big hole in the floor that everybody was stepping around. That's like, did he have a brain injury as a child? Like, really? What are you saying by not saying this?
Right. Like, what was his IQ? What were his developmental? Was he developmentally delayed? Like, what? You know, and can being incapable of lying be a defense? It actually kind of reminded me of our last discussion about Ted Bundy, which is, you know, he was kind of this master of lying, like, you know, right into the end, you still never knew what the truth was.
Right.
He just didn't have that, or he did. It's part of like why in this very messed up way he's been this like anti-hero for so long is because he's a sociopath, and we kind of value that in our society. And the defense of John Wayne Bobbitt was that he is not a sociopath, which I believe to be true. That doesn't mean he's not a violent predator.
Right. Like I think that he has perhaps as a result of abuse or concussion suffered as a kid, or I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I don't know him. We weren't told these things except sort of as a drive-by towards the end.
Yep.
Anything that might, and again, this is not to make excuses for him, of course, but the number of times that it came up that he was basically like not able to lie because he doesn't have the mental or like psychological wherewithal, that he could not hold a job,
right.
That, I mean, there was something there that we weren't being told. And again, it wouldn't excuse his actions or his behavior, but
it is important, like when we're looking back at these cases too, to like, I mean, the goal is to also understand, you know, not just, you know, how people get away with this in the justice system, but like also, you know, how this cycle of abuse starts and where it starts, and, you know, and especially when there is this reveal that he was abused as a child. Which I think we also saw in the excellent R. Kelly documentary, with a lot more depth and a lot more kind of like, you know, you don't get into the complete specifics in R. Kelly, but you do learn that, like, you know, he was raised in a family of sexual abuse. You kind of, you know, it doesn't excuse his actions, but it helps us kind of start to understand root causes, and if we're going to change things, you know, where we need to look and how we need to treat people.
Right. And if there was some kind of like cranial impact, I think studies have been done.
Yeah.
Correlating, like, it's not a, you know, it's not 100%, but I believe there is a, you know, higher than like outside the statistical norm correlation between violent behavior and impulse control in, you know, convicted felons and brain injury, like concussions, being beaten up. And again,
Fernandez. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not an excuse, but it's not irrelevant either. But of course, you know, I think we know a lot more about these things generally about predators and the sort of red flags about brain injury, about testing for this kind of thing, and about the, you know, cycles and sort of, I hate to use the word evolution, but the, you know, the way that domestic violence in a relationship is escalated or can escalate over time. Mm-hmm. But I think in the mid 90s, we didn't know as much. And even if we did, everything was sort of focused on the penis.
Oh my God. So, I mean, literally that the day you find out that, like, you know, the day and the moment that, you know, John Wayne Bobbitt's penis is cut off and he's in the hospital, the Lorena is is going to the police and saying that she was abused, and they're like, we can't talk about this yet. We need to find the penis. That really struck me, where it was just like, whatever you're going through in your domestic violence thing, it's really, it's nothing compared to a missing penis, you know?
Yeah.
Which really set the tone.
There was that great line from one of the workers at the Bunny Ranch, who was like, they can cut a million clits off in Africa, nobody gives a shit, but one
she
penis and the whole world stops. It's a man's world. Yeah, she was great.
Mm-hmm.
They were all pretty amazing. Like the whole Bunny Ranch sequence of his life. Those Talking Head interviews were pretty amazing. But I thought the series also did a good job locating us in the timeline of... like the way that many of these stories and issues were set up as this like very one-dimensional, like, you know, men like sports, women like shopping disagreement.
Yep.
That's like, yep. People have been sexually assaulted, sexually harassed, driven out of their jobs. This is not some cutesy, like, you know, the ad with the Marine and his wife's Pomeranian. Like, this is not cute. And I thought they did a really good job of locating us sort of in the middle of this timeline that included the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, the Tailhook scandal, which, like, it was not a scandal. Crimes were committed.
Yeah. Right.
The murder
exactly.
of Nicole and Ron. Monica Lewinsky and all that. So here's clip three.
I don't think that there was a lot of surprise from most women around Anita Hill or William Kennedy Smith or Tailhook. Even those of us who have been watching these issues, we were just used to nothing happening.
We're used to. Grab him by the pussy, nominate Kavanaugh. Like, gee, I'm really glad the world is a much different, friendlier place for women. JK.
Yeah, Jesus. I you know what struck me was one of the reporters were talking about how they were never allowed to use the word penis in a headline, and how this.
Oh yeah,
this
we
suddenly,
that's
like,
actually our next clip.
Oh, excuse, sorry.
And then,
yes.
Oh no, that's fine. But I love that they also have the urologist in there making what seem inadvertent puns, but he is like, this guy's like super excited.
He loves this. He loves it. He's like, did someone want to talk about John Wayne Bobbitt?
No. And then he'll make the joke, and then he'll be like, eh? Like, yeah, we got that it was a joke. Anyway, here's clip four, and then we can get back into it.
Mm-hmm. At the time, you could not say penis. You did not say that in family newspapers. So how do you refer to this body part?
Well, it's interesting about the word penis, because my father was an OBGYN, and my father didn't even use the anatomical words for what he did, both for men or women. It was just their generation. They didn't call it what it was. Of course, I was using penis a lot, had to in this case, you know. I'm not going to... You cut off your ding-a-ling. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I think this was the first time that that word came out of the closet in American culture in the New York Times. I think the V word had already been out to some degree, but it was a cultural moment for the P word to get some airing.
I mean, out of the closet to get some airing. All right, Dr. Rain, we see you.
Well, for me, I think the big P word in this was panties. Because apparently that is a fine word to use over and over again instead of like undergarments, something. I felt like there could have been something like a little bit more technical and less just like panties when they were talking about her underpants. And the entire part of the case, you know, against him when she was accusing him of rape. One of the things that made the jury be like, aha, she manipulated everything, was that she, her underpants were ripped, and someone with a pair of scissors, came like on the, like, didn't they come on the, like, the defense stand or something and like showed how you could cut panties.
And there was some juror who was like, and where does she work?
Right. A nail salon.
And what do they have there? I'm like, nail polish?
Scissors. Right. Like, just like
cuticle scissors. Like, what? That is really...
A huge leap. And the fact that would in any way be a defense of him, of like, she scissored her panty, her underpants. I was very upset by the use of panties for some reason. I felt like there was this kind of like infantilizing, like hypersexual, like little girl thing in using that type of language for something.
Yeah, I'm
about
not a big fan
violence
of,
and abuse.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that word anyway. And like,
no.
You know, you hear the word penis and like you see the sort of disengaged piece of the penis a few times, and you see, you know, like it can be stern stuff. So if you like, that's going to be happening, not a lot, but if you can't take that, I get it, but be warned. But then the use of the word panties, it was like 40 times in 5 minutes. And mm-hmm. I absolutely agree that there is something like tickle pillow fight porny mm-hmm. about it. Like, mm-hmm. just say underwear or, like, mm-hmm. even, like, the word underpants is not great either, but drawers, like, there's a gazillion synonyms.
Undergarments, yep.
Yeah, that you could use, like, briefs. I don't care anything else, but there is something very diminishing about using the word panties, and everything it seemed about the John Wayne defense strategy was designed to... mm-hmm. diminish her and make her look like a crazy bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think it worked on a lot of people, not...
And a sex fiend, too.
Yeah.
You know, there was also a lot of that of just like, she just wanted an orgasm because her initial statement, which of course was like, English was her second language, she was traumatized, she was, you know, who even knows the situation that she was in when she was first reporting what had happened to police? She was definitely not represented by an attorney at the time, but they used that against her again and again as if her reasoning for cutting off his penis was that she wasn't getting pleasure first.
Well, and I love that was immediately like, all right, I'm not going to cut anyone's dick off over that, but that's a fair clock.
It can be frustrating.
It's like, what a selfish bitch. Like, well, all right, yes, to hack his dick off over that, which if you really think that's what happened, you're insane,
God.
And you don't understand how human beings react to things, but I mean,
and what trauma is, and like years of it. Yeah.
Well, and it's like perfectly understandable to me that this is how she initially reports it, because first of all, he had been threatening her with deportation, which she believed.
Yep. Yep.
She had had no other romantic or sexual relationships mm-hmm. before him, and was sufficiently devout that to get a divorce would have felt like a failure to her.
Marital rape wasn't a thing, you know. I mean,
she
that's
was
like this
being abused and was ashamed. I mean, we have another clip before this, but let me just skip ahead to clip 6 because this is part of her testimony from, I believe, her trial, where she's talking about, you know, some attorney is like, "And how come you didn't tell anyone?" Like, really, bro? Here's clip 6.
Did you tell anybody about this?
No, I didn't. No, I couldn't.
Why not?
Because I was... I couldn't understand why the person that I love have react that way. I couldn't understand why my husband hit me. I couldn't understand many things. I was in shock. I couldn't believe that. I was embarrassed to tell people also. And I thought he might change. He never going to do it again.
I mean, absolutely classic, like, you know, self-report of what she must have been feeling. And this is someone who, you know, he made her get an abortion. And this is also someone who got the, you know, got a racist profile of her own. Yep. As the, like, fiery Latinx Hellcat. Mm-hmm. Was fighting him all the time, like,
and just wanted to stay in this country. I mean, that's, yeah, and was completely just dismissed as a human and by him, and then later by the public. Yeah,
yeah, and then they sort of were trying. He has this pretty ugly bit in the last episode where he's talking about some shit that went down with his second wife. Mm-hmm. Tigers don't change their stripes. Yep. But he's like, well, you know, the immigrant and the gold digger, they both act the same. They just want something from you. And it's like, and what in your, you know, super awesome earner, unable to lie, abusive. Uh-huh. But yeah, like what exactly would anyone want from you? A 36 ounce beverage container, because that you got. Yeah, I thought they did a good job making these things clear. Like, there were some parts of it where I felt like there was a little bit of extra extra air, like extra packing material. Mm-hmm. But maybe I, you know, without realizing it, I did need a break from some of the testimony. And I think that when it came to unpacking everything that was going on and that was sort of going wrong in terms of what we should have been focusing on, Lorena does a really good job doing that, but not underlining it. It has a good sense of the story's own timing, and it gets excellent access to attorneys, jurors, both of the, you know, former Bobbitts in her case, like commentators. I thought they had a really good range of people on screen. And this one juror is rather frustrated with what she sees the evidence, what she sees as the evidence in clip five.
We got pictures of where she, you know, where she threw it, what she used. That was a big sidetrack moment for us. We weren't allowed to discuss anything before or after, really. And then you kind of get hung up on the knife and the what and the everything. And I think that maybe we lost sight of what he truly was on trial for.
And there's also a sort of montage of like top 10 lists that Letterman did about it. SNL sketches, one of them featuring Al Franken. Not a great look in retrospect. Yeah, I thought it was really well assembled and did a good job talking about the fact that the actual act and the penis just blocked everything else out.
Ugh, and I mean, the one moment that I just cannot get out of my head is on Howard Stern when he... So, you know, obviously John Wayne is just a regular guest there at some point, but he was like, of course you didn't rape her. Look at her. She wasn't that attractive. I mean, that, which again, I was just like, oh, Donald Trump. That's like another, like, insane, sick defense. And you hear this just on like regular talk radio, as if this is like, oh yeah, that's an actual plausible thing. Of like, I mean, it was a time, and it still is a time that men could talk about rape in this way and dismiss it as if, you know, and dismisses it as if it's something a woman should want from a man.
Yeah. Just the way that, you know, that Howard Stern is like still a thing. I mean,
I
get it. And there are things that, like I read both his memoirs, and you know, there are things that I admire him for in terms of like just physically getting it done every day, especially when he was suffering from severe OCD, and that he's had this very long career and understands the build of a show. Like, fine. But there are things and people that he is associated with and sucked up to that just ruins all of that. And Robin sitting nearby and being like,
laughing and validating.
Yeah, yeah, just it really makes me sad because these are talented people who are collaborators now. And I can't like I can't sign off on anything that they do or anyone that goes on that show. It's just it's just gross. And then they have like this fundraiser for his like defense.
Right.
Fund.
That's right.
And that instead of like the little red needle showing how much they raised, it's this giant, extremely detailed cock.
Oh, God. Yes, yes.
I mean, ugh. And then there's the sense that this person, like, he does the porno because whatever. How else is he going to make money? Which, okay. Like, I think that is factually true. He had no choice.
Yeah.
But the he has this augmentation surgery, and it's like,
and that goes wrong.
Should this person perhaps be made a ward of the state? Like, I'm really asking. Like, I just don't think this person is capable of, like, making his way in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. But
and yet, what's, he persists.
Yeah. I mean, but it's so interesting because here, you know, on one side you have, yeah, like the Stern Show raising money for his defense. And then you have this incredibly beautiful moment later in the series where all of these immigrants, Latin American immigrants, come together to support Lorena.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I really thought that was lovely. That they're all like,
I like was weeping.
Carpooling from all over the... From all over the sort of area, the capital area, which, like, it's a pain to get around.
Yes. And it's like people taking off time of their jobs. It's freezing outside, mm-hmm. but nobody has been supporting her. She has been, not only is like few people have been supporting her, but like she's, as we've said, been diminished. Her, this part of the, you know, her testimony. And by the end, you see that, like, you know, there is testimony after testimony of witnesses that are saying she was abused. Like, she didn't want to talk about it, but there were bruises all over her body every day. You know, this is something that can't be ignored. And to have a community rally around her, and, you know, and it's a community that, you know, is not the, like, you know, empowered white male. It was like a really beautiful moment to see.
And it really was fucking cold. I remember that winter. I was a senior in college, and like the entire state of New Jersey ran out of salt and cinders because it had snowed so much so many times. So it was really like, it really was a sacrifice above and beyond to be standing out there for, as someone pointed out, basically 30 seconds of her going into the courtroom and 30 seconds of her leaving to be there with signs and cheer for her. They would stay out there in the freezing cold all day. And that's, I mean, that's really something. Like, you know, at least there's some hope for humanity somewhere.
Yeah.
But it may not be in the press. I also think Lorena does a good job not sort of hoisting the press with their own petard or anything like that, but just raising the question of how, of what the responsibility is and was of people covering the story. Like, we heard this, we heard the clip right up top of this, I believe, Washington Post reporter saying, you know, everybody is trying to get the same story and you'd like to think that ethics are going to prevail, but the scoop kind of always comes first. And you get the distinct sense, at least from a certain Vanity Fair correspondent, that, they really weren't interested in the human at the center of it at all. So here's clip 7, and then I'd like to know what you think of Kim Masters's attitude in this clip.
It was very clear from my Vanity Fair editor that had Lorena and John not been an attractive couple, it would have been much less of a thing. There was a whole deal about what was Lorena going to wear. She came with a Mickey Mouse shirt, I think. one of the things that Jana said at the outset was there is no way Lorena is going to get into her, be shot in her bathing suit in the pool. It took Mary Ellen about 5 minutes to get her in the bathing suit in the pool.
What are you saying, Kim Masters?
Oof, it's a little judgy.
It's a big judgy.
It's really condescending. It's
implying
it
that she's a fame
good.
Whore and like a, you know, simpleton.
And stupid.
Yeah,
yep.
Like the Mickey Mouse shirt is just like, I think she's wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt. And then they show a picture of her in it, which if mm-hmm. the thread running under this is American Dream, American Nightmare, mm-hmm. of course you're going to put her in a fucking Mickey shirt. Like that's basic. That's like first day.
Right.
Visual aids shit. Sorry. But
right,
you know, I did not care for that attitude, and I was pretty impressed yeah. that the production team got her to sort of be that snotty and left it in. Good.
Yes.
But she does say up top, like, you know, word from the top was, or my sense from the top was, if this hadn't been an American Dream turned American Nightmare thing, this story wouldn't have had legs. And this series raises a lot of questions, or sort of pushes more on questions that have been getting raised over the last few weeks vis-a-vis the Ted Bundy series, and whether consumers of and commenters on true crime are complicit, and what responsibility we have to the victims in a crime story and who these stories belong to. But again, without, they don't underline it too much, and I really appreciated that and have been spending, you know, the last couple of weeks thinking about that myself. Was that something that was brought up for you with this series or with Ted Bundy or any other time?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, even just kind of checking myself, you know, especially with kind of stories like Ted Bundy that are titillating, before you kind of recognize that there's like a larger impact to these stories, and that also just like there are real victims here and their stories are really not being told. They're really glossed over. And I think, you know, that was something I recognized right away in the Ted Bundy documentary. And in part, it's not because I'm amazing. It's because I've done so much research on Ted Bundy in the past that I'm like, I know all this, but like, you know, but also just like,
it can
this,
be
like,
both things, Piper.
It
you
can be
amazing.
Can be.
And yeah.
it's definitely not that I'm amazing. But yeah, the like I do think that we're in that moment where we're starting to just like check ourselves. And I even kind of had that moment in Lorena, and I think again they did a really good job of like showing not telling this. In towards the end, there's this very cool woman who was watching the trial and realized that she had been told by Lorena, and she had seen bruises all over Lorena.
Oh yeah, but she wasn't sure. Yes,
she had missed the first trial, and she got in touch with the defense attorney
because she thought Lorena's name was Lena.
She thought Lorena's Lena because she was her nail salon person. Right. So the irony and kind of interesting thing about this is this woman kind of sweeps in at the last minute in Lorena Bobbitt's trial where they're trying her for you know, violence. And what were they trying her for?
Malicious maiming.
Malicious maiming. Okay.
Right.
And she gives this very excellent testimony about how this woman was, you know, she had seen bruises on her, she was certain that she was abused, but the kind of like subtext was, oh, a rich white lady is saying this, all right, now we believe her. And there was, you know, all this talk about how what a great witness she was, and you know, and I think that that's, you know, that's a lot of this story that I might not have recognized a couple of years ago, but like this seems so like blaring and important in this story that like, you know, Lorena Bobbitt's own testimony was less important or, you know, really kind of dismissed until just like a wealthy white woman kind of came in and was like, no, it's true, you know? And you yeah, know, it still had to be a woman, not a man, but like, you know, it's just like, that's our system. And it reminded me of Anita Hill, you know, and just like, you know, the odds stacked against a woman of color talking about sexual harassment or abuse, of just like that their voices are just constantly diminished and dismissed.
Yeah. And that there are also issues of, I mean, race, you see this all the time, in terms of like, you know, when a blonde white girl goes missing, it's like an all points bulletin. When an African-American girl goes missing, like the Tales of the Grim Sleeper documentary, where they're like, of course, this guy was able to prey on women of color for years on end because they were women of color and That's possibly right. marginal. But what you also see, I think, in this case and in the next in our next segment, is that there's a class issue at work and that there's something about, like, the ability to decide that either perpetrators or victims are trash and then put the whole thing at the curb in our minds is something that I think is not healthy and is not justice. So
that's right.
When commentators are talking about a, quote, tabloid story or like popular crime stories, what they're often really saying is these are trashy.
That's right.
Junkies who, you know, and it's like, well,
this isn't about bankers. Nobody ever talks about a banking story as being tabloid, even though like those stories can be just as seedy. Obviously stories about the White House are just as seedy. And yet like, yeah, they're not considered because it's a class thing. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, like Elliot Spitzer. I mean, I still feel like he should not have got strung up for that and wouldn't have been if he hadn't pissed off the bankers in New York State. That's the subject of another podcast, but there's absolutely class shit at work. Our final clip in this section is a, I think, former Newsweek editor who got... They had some cover story that didn't run because he got, quote, out tabloided by the Nancy Kerrigan, Tanya Harding story that happened that week. And then he's sort of being very defensive that he's like, not everything has to be spinach. And he's sort of defending infotainment, which I think is maybe the wrong angle to take on this. Like, he's right, but I think he's arguing the wrong angle. Anyway, here's clip 8.
That's it. Yeah.
Tabloid fans are certainly getting their fill this week.
A man who had been videotaping Kerrigan hit her on the leg with a club.
And in Los Angeles, there is the continuing drama of the Menendez brothers.
CNN has been following this third day of Lorena Bobbitt's trial in Manassas, Virginia. That's
there was a lot. There was great fodder. You know, this was a wonderful time for tabloid TV.
I think that the line that used to be drawn between news and entertainment is now blurred, and I don't think that's a very good idea.
There's nothing wrong with journalism being entertaining. Not everything has to be spinach. There's nothing wrong with tabloid stories.
I mean, yeah, but also, no. Like, I don't know.
Well, calling this a tabloid story is part of why this was so messed up to begin with. Like,
it as a tabloid story, like calling it a tabloid story is dismissing it.
It's basically also saying like women's stories. Yeah. You know, I mean, like years that has been of just like tabloid newspapers were sold at the supermarket for women, you know, and it's just like because they deal with like actual, you know, like, you know, marital issues and sometimes issues of domestic violence, you know? I mean,
yeah. And it's like Hollywood Confidential or anything else, that if you can kind of dismiss it on any grounds, but certainly calling it a tabloid story is an easy way to not have to pay attention to it or take it seriously, even though the issues in the case are deadly serious, literally.
Yes.
So, and then, you know, yes. you see that in the case that we're about to talk about, in my opinion. Oh,
can I just say, I remembered one thing and I totally forgot to write it down and I wish that we had a clip of it, but Whoopi Goldberg, we see a lot of clips of people making jokes, right? Mm. And about, but I will say that I forgot the how funny Whoopi Goldberg was, and her stand-up about this was actually
really on point. I did consider pulling a clip of this. Yes, I agree.
Okay. Yeah, it was like, it was one of those moments where I just like found myself clapping and being like, okay, if you're going to make a joke, that's the right angle. Like, which was basically what other commentators were saying, just like in a less stand-up way, but it was just like women are coming together and being like, I kind of understand this, you know, and that's the thing that people aren't talking about. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Whoopi.
Yeah,
in her stand-up prime.
Yeah, I also considered pulling a clip of Steve Harvey sort of, I mean, just being Steve Harvey about it, because Steve Harvey gonna Steve Harvey, but he's, you know, he's like, why'd you take it with you? It's like, do you not understand anything about trauma? Like, I mean,
that also kind of like broke my heart a little bit, because in the end, you know, you see Lorena Bobbitt also kind of partaking in some of these jokes. You know, she goes on the Steve Harvey show and she like knows that she's going to be asked these questions, mm-hmm. and she kind of giggles along with it. But then she tells, you know, the documentarian, she's like, you know, if I can get the word out about domestic violence to people that, you know, maybe aren't still talking about it, like, I'm going to take a couple, I'm going to suck up a few jokes. And I was like, that is, I was hat tipping her for that. I mean, that's got to be not easy. And I wouldn't blame her for having a lot of resentment or for kind of, you know, going into hiding after this, or for, you know, not for only doing interviews that, you know, are, you know, take this situation seriously. But she's also like aware of like reaching a wider audience. And I think,
yeah, and has definitely really done the work sort of off radar with domestic violence organizations, shelters, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, she, what an sort of amazing gauntlet. And like some of the recreations of the press, just like shooting, turning the light on the camera on and shooting like into her house and going into crawl spaces, like, and to just have to wait for that to end.
Yes.
And she did. And she does seem at peace. And for a story that was all of the worst moments of her life replayed endlessly, you know, this, you don't necessarily think that there's going to be a great outcome, but she's a warrior for sure. So, and this series is excellent and I recommend it. It's really well done. Again, there were some sequences that I thought might have been better spent, but overall I thought it was great.
I agree.
Moving on to the cold case section, which I don't think I realized was tied like quite so closely to the same issues and sort of the same time frame as Lorena and that whole like mini 90s timeline of these issues. We are contemplating an old school HBO documentary called Talked to Death, It is available on YouTube, and there will be a link in the show notes. Here is a case file adapted from Wikipedia. On March 6th, 1995, Scott Amador, is that how you pronounce it? Amador?
Yes, I believe okay. so.
Taped an episode of The Jenny Jones Show in which he admitted to being a secret admirer of Jonathan Schmitz, who lived near him in Lake Orion, Michigan. Until the taping, Schmitz had no idea who his secret admirer was. Schmitz stated that he went on the show out of curiosity and later claimed that the producers implied that his admirer was a woman, although the producers of the show claimed that they did tell Schmitz that the admirer could be male or female. During the segment, Amador was encouraged by Jones to share his fantasies about Schmitz, after which Schmitz was brought on stage. In response to Amador's disclosure, Schmitz laughed, then stated that he was, quote, completely heterosexual. A friend of Amador's later stated that Amador and Schmitz went out drinking together the night of the taping, and an alleged sexual encounter occurred. According to the testimony at the murder trial 3 days after the taping, Amador left a, quote, suggestive note at Schmitz's house. After finding it, Schmitz withdrew money from the bank, purchased a shotgun, and went to Amador's mobile home. He questioned Amador about the note. Schmitz then returned to his car, took his gun, and returned to Amador's trailer to shoot Amador twice in the chest, killing him. After killing Amador, Schmitz left the residence, called 911, and confessed to the killing. End of case file. If it hadn't happened on or to Jenny Jones, it was probably going to happen regardless. The mid-90s were the height, or the nadir, of daytime tawdriness with Jenny, Sally Jesse, Montel, Geraldo, Ricky, Richard Bay, and to a lesser extent, Oprah and Phil Donahue competing for those train wreck eyeballs. I Took Your Man, This Baby Ain't Yours, and other behind-closed-doors revelations, real and imagined, more on that in a moment, took over the afternoon airwaves, with each show trying to outdo all the others and themselves. So it was only a matter of time before one of the real secrets got someone killed. 1997's Talked to Death, The Dark Side of TV Talk Shows, covers the murder of Scott Amador and explores many of the same issues and indictments of the quote-unquote press that Lorena does, but with a lot more defensive posturing from the hosts and a lot more firsthand info commentary from your host, a veteran of Ricky Lake's I've Got a Secret to Tell You episode. No, there will be no clips because the segment that I found on YouTube featuring yours truly as Alice, who has a secret to tell her friend Kimberly, is no longer available. More on that later. This is just an hour long, and it's sort of from that like bronze age of HBO documentaries, like The Iceman. What was the other one you mentioned before we started recording?
Child of Rage.
Yes, Child of Rage. It is directed by, I had a note on this that I can't find. Oh, yes. Ames Yates, I believe, is the name. Who had done a bunch of America Undercovers, which was their other, I think, sub-series about like anxiety, depression, the rise of methamphetamine. It looks cheap because it's from 1997 and it has that like flat video look. But overall, I thought it was... I'd seen it before ages ago. I thought it was really entertaining. I thought it sort of accidentally pantsed Geraldo and Phil Donahue and some of the others to an extent.
So what once titillated and attracted us in drama is now attracting us with real characters from real life situations who are on the stage and often encouraged to be animated and scream at the other guests by the producer of the program.
You bring me out to Chicago for me to find this out.
I'm sorry.
As we know that noise will stop the channel surfer.
Yes. Thank you, Phil Donahue. At least he has some insight. I'm not sure that necessarily stopped him from, you know, participating in this arms race, but I did like his comments. I did like that Geraldo was kind of allowed to hang himself by being a rationalizing jackass, which, as one of the stars of Celebrity Apprentice, who was really close with the Donald, I'm fucking fine with that. And I liked the, there was like one storyline in one show that they, it was a Geraldo episode that they sort of followed, and they followed this one associate producer who was like really frustrated that this one woman who's like being ranked on by her friend in this very complicated love quadrangle that sounded made up, who knows, was like so uncomfortable that she was like laughing. And during the breaks, it was like this longitudinal study of guests being massaged by the producers, which mm-hmm. I thought was quite damning and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting. Another thing that kind of stuck out for me was there's this story, this kind of talk show fighting story for this one woman who had tried to remove her own breast implants, and Maury Povich said something like, you know, now this is a great story. And what he's really talking about is just like a story of a woman mutilating herself, of just like, why is that a great story? Like, why does this hit all of the like winning points of what people want to see? You know, in a lot of ways, like that kind of spoke to me of just like, you know, like violence against women as a form of entertainment was definitely like a template for a lot of these shows. And, you know, and then of course we see it translated to like, you know, violence against, you know, anyone who's been marginalized in the Jenny Jones attack.
Well, and here again, you're seeing that issue of class play out, that I think there is sort of still a presumed trashiness to breast implants for any other purpose besides post breast cancer reconstruction. Mm. And that certainly what these talk shows seem to be going for was the topic that could create the greatest feelings of superiority in the viewer based on their relative situation, which is why you have many so-called like trashy topics like, you know, I'd fuck my sister's husband, or whose baby is it? Like who was the guy? Was it Springer who had like a regular like paternity test?
It was Maury.
So they're like, and because these people are not necessarily married to each other, but have children together, there's definitely this like class yes. structure assumptions about that and about non-traditional households. And it just is unsavory in its intent, I feel. And
preying on not like what are the circumstances surrounding this situation in a very real way. It was like always preying on the emotional aspects of any kind of like difficulties. So the backstory right. was less important than like the moment that someone like let out their feelings, you know, in a very like stage worthy way, yes. which is like the most dangerous thing you can do, you know,
well, there's
it's like
no...
cruel.
Yeah. There's no, there's very little attention to the backstory. And then what happens afterward is of zero concern.
Right.
As we'll hear in clip 11 from one participant who I must confess that I was a little bit unclear as to what exactly was being confessed to. I think her sister had ambushed her with the information that she, the sister, had slept with the ambushee's husband in order to get the husband to stop beating the ambushee. Is that correct?
That's correct. The subtext here, which they do kind of talk about without talking about, it's very John Wayne Bobbitty, is that something happened to them when they were growing up.
Right.
In which the sister feels that protecting her sister from abuse means sleeping with her sister's partner, you know? And again, that's not really, you know, explored, of just like the psychology behind that and like whatever tragic, traumatic situation they were both put in as children is just like kind of cast aside. And it's just like, say what, you know, like it's just the moment of this kind of horrifying revelation. And I can't even imagine.
Yeah. And then I believe this was Montel, and she's pretty clear in clip 11 that once they had rung this gotcha for what it was worth, there was no further interest in their story. Clip 11.
Just unreal. Why you want to do something to someone like that? What gives these talk shows and their, producers the right to do this to people, number one, and then send you home, you know, without a care and never even contact you again to see how your life is. Are you all right? Nothing.
Ugh.
I mean, yeah. And then
that woman, I fell for her hardcore.
God, yeah. And then her sister, who, like, you're sort of watching this go on and it's like, I cannot imagine what, if any part of this is genuine. Yeah. And I did feel like something had happened in the past.
Yeah.
Even if nothing had happened in the present, the sister felt guilty for abuse that she had failed to, like, lightning rod away from.
Mm-hmm.
Her sister, I mean, this is so far above everyone involved's pay grade. That it's not even funny. But then, you know, then you have some guy who's like the head of the Daytime Talk Show Broadcasters Association of Shitwits or whatever his title was, being like, look, you know, we're just trying to, like, we make 200 sausages a year and you got to have one that they remember so that people tune in because they don't want to miss the next one. And it's like, oh, I almost felt sorry for you, content creator. Oh, wait, that's over. Here's clip 10.
I mean, you have to remember, we do 200 shows a year, but there are 7 shows that they talk about. And, you know, all these many years later, they're still talking about Geraldo getting his nose broken. I mean, it was 8 years ago. They're still talking about Al Capone's vault, which was 10 years ago. Geraldo walks down the street, and like it was yesterday, Geraldo, how's your nose?
I mean, yeah, I remember Al Capone's vault. What a fucking scam. But, I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
With Geraldo, like it's all just
violence.
Brand. Yeah.
Yeah. That was like the thing. I remember the nose breaking thing. And that was like talk show wrestling at its peak.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's interesting that we still are grappling with these notions of the responsibility of, I mean, I hesitate to call these shows the press.
Yeah.
But I think there are ethical considerations that pertain just as human beings. And then the people who work on the shows kind of putting the responsibility on the viewers to understand that a lot of it is fake, like professional wrestling, and on the guests that they're sort of like, well, it's not our fault that guns are so easy to get and he's a homophobe. And it's like, well, no, but you, like, he wouldn't have done the show if he thought it was going to be a dude. So that should have told you how that was going to go.
Well, also, they didn't do background checks on, you know, he had a history of mental illness and substance abuse that, you know, that was the family of Amador's case against the show, was that they didn't, you know, do the research to figure out that, like, this guy's reaction might not necessarily be something he's prepared to handle in a way that's safe for other people.
Well, and they'd also put booze in the green room, yeah?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I mean,
they
and
said
then,
they didn't, but, or did they say they were just like, no, he was already drinking, but there was booze in the green room.
Yeah. Well, and their ability to sort of split hairs, that they're like, there may have been booze in the green room. I didn't put it there. Like the number of associated producers who were like, I did see a vodka bottle, but you won't find my prints on it. Like,
that's it.
That's an oddly specific response to that. Our final clip is this unaired segment. in which Jenny Jones is almost clocking herself and her own guests for this content.
Now, which of these ways would you choose to reveal your secret crush on someone? A, would you write that person a letter? B, would you tell the person in private in case he rejects you? Or C, would you tell that person that you're gay and you hope he is on national television?
And, you know, these are the audience members at the Coliseum hoping that they see a Christian get et by a lion.
Yep. Yep.
That's what they're cheering for. They like they want there to be a brawl.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
and all like triggered by, you know, instead of just like a giant red ribbon, it's just like by some kind of like psychological trigger, you know, like that's it's so dark.
And that she sort of gives the audience permission to despise, but also slow down to watch the car wreck of these guests. Mm-hmm. That she's like, well, this is fucking stupid, but at least they're on my show. Like, oh, God. And then she's on the stand. I do remember this trial.
Yeah.
And I do remember feeling not sorry for her, but like if anyone had gotten it, she got it. Like she's on the stand. Yes. She looks like hell. She's all puffy. She clearly feels terrible.
She lost her job at this point, too.
Yeah. And then she was, I think, sued personally. Her show was sued. She was sued personally. Like, I mean, you know, someone learned their lesson. Cool.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. So it was interesting to revisit this in light of Lorena and in light of this discussion that a lot of people have been having the last couple of weeks about, you know, where the shame center is in true crime and what it is about it that both attracts us and maybe should repel us more.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I also, the other thing that I thought was interesting about this case or kind of disheartening about this case is that Schmitz's defense attorney used the quote unquote gay panic defense, which I did not know was a thing. Which is temporary insanity due to same sex sexual advances. And I mean, it did not go over, which, you know, this actually, he was sentenced to 20 to 40 years in prison, but he just got out in 2017. But also equally alarming to me is that the gay panic defense in the U.S. has only been banned explicitly by 3 states. So it's still actually being used. I mean, it's just another sign of just like such pervasive homophobia that, like, you know, that is honestly like at the core of this case, like not just, you know, whatever triggered this guy individually, Schmitz, but also, you know, a show kind of knowing that there's some kind of like implicit shame that is going to be placed on someone for, you know, a member of the same sex finding them attractive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
especially at that point.
Yes.
I think this was still a few years before Matthew Shepard.
But it was.
I think that was still.
Which also used the gay panic defense.
And the gay panic defense is one that I'm familiar with mostly from Law and Order episodes. But the various Law and Order franchises have played on the Amador case. It just kept coming back. It was kind of amazing. And they would like put a little twist on it and try to explore like, well, who was really responsible for this? And then sometimes it would be the radio version. And sometimes it was something that happened on like a Morton Downey episode instead of this show. But when you were chasing down the case from your book, were there any shows that had like a half decent treatment of it, or was it all this kind of like gawking?
Oh, yeah. It was all this kind of gawking. The other thing that happened was that kind of a violent aspect of the actual crime was captured on camera by a local cameraman who just happened to be on a ride along with the police and was doing his job, you know, and was just covering the incident. But there was a bidding war between Inside Edition, Hard Copy, and A Current Affair, which were kind of like the origin shows of these later talk shows, for the raw footage of the violence. So that was interesting. And it also kind of like, then it spawned articles of just like, you know, has television gone too far? And of course, the irony of all of that was that just like, oh, just wait till the internet happens. Of just like, this is nothing. But yeah, there was kind of like, I find that whole like period of salacious television in the like, you know, right before the internet, or kind of coinciding with the very beginning of the internet, really interesting, because there's this kind of like general frothing for just like more, let's just like have more guttural reactions to the things that we see on TV, and everything has to feel real and alive and exposed. And it really was just kind of a precursor for the way that we live now, which, you know, in some ways I think is like, you know, evolved in a really smart way. And then of course we have examples of the opposite today, but
yeah, that there's that, like, you know, that instant gratification can always happen, but there's also like dopamine receptor problems involved in the availability of any of this stuff. Pornography, yes. Violence, violent pornography,
yes.
Geraldo,
oh god.
All right, well, this once again is called Talked to Death, I think. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
And it is on YouTube. It's probably somewhere in the HBO Go archives as well. But frankly, it's not going to look a whole lot better watching it on Apple TV than it is just watching it on YouTube. So we'll link that in the show notes. And speaking of said book that you were researching, Piper, please tell listeners more about that and whatever you're working on right now.
Sure. Yeah. My book I've given a little bit of backgrounds about growing up in the early 90s in New York City, and a tennis coach that I had who turned out to be a child stalker. I was not aware of it at the time. In fact, I thought he was one of the few adults in the world that could understand me. So it's kind of told a reexamination of that perspective and why I might have had it at age 14 as a girl. And then a reinvestigation into the case against him. Now I'm working on a bunch of other projects, you know, some, hopefully doing some TV, because I watch a lot of television, and working on a book about groupies. And yeah, it's basically exploring the same themes that perpetually interested in, which is like female teendom and you know, our the way that we're kind of like undermined in more subtle shades of gray than we realize at the time,
and also pretty blatantly. Thank you so
and
much
also,
for
yes.
Thank you so much for coming back to talk about these issues with me again, and hopefully I can get you back for Sundance's take on the Preppy murder, which, if I recall correctly,
yes,
was the crime that first bonded us on this topic.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes. Yes.
Good
yes,
old
yes.
Robert Chambers. Can't.
I've got
can't,
a lot to say.
Can't seem to figure it out. Oh, yes. Mm. So do I. I look forward to it.
Me too.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Kevin Smokler on The Onion Fields, both book and movie, Leaving Neverland, even more Theranos, even more Adnan Syed, and of course, Robert Chambers. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? You can find me on social media, that's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. And become an official Blotter tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. Like the podcast? Tell a friend and give it a 5-star rating on iTunes. Don't like the podcast? Tell no one. My guest has been Piper Weiss, and she is on Twitter, I'm going to get it right this time, at @ThePiperWeiss. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.